All right, let's dive into a real head scratcher today, a case that asks, can you be guilty of trying to murder someone who is already dead?
Sounds like we're in for a wild ride.
You got that right. We're talking about People v. Dlugacz, a 1977 case that really bends your mind about how intent and action work in the law.
I'm all ears, lay it on me.
Picture this, a classic crime scene. Our victim has multiple gunshot wounds. But the mystery isn't who shot him, but were those last shots the ones that actually killed him?
Ooh, that's a twist. What makes Dlugacz so fascinating is that it throws a wrench into how we usually think about murder, right? We tend to think, someone does something, that action leads to someone's death, bam, case closed. But here, it gets blurry. Really blurry.
So, set the scene for us. What exactly went down?
Okay, 1973, Brooklyn, three guys, Melvin Dlugacz, Michael Geller, and Joe Bush hanging out in Geller's apartment, having some drinks. Things get heated, argument over unpaid rent, and Bush ends up shooting Geller multiple times in the chest.
So, at this point, seems pretty open and shut, right? Bush is our murderer.
Hold on, Avish Moore. This is where it gets interesting. A few minutes after those first shots, Dlugacz fires five shots into Geller's head.
Five shots. Yikes.
Now, the million-dollar question. Was Geller already dead from Bush's shots when Dlugacz fired? And did Dlugacz think he was shooting a living person?
Okay, so even if Dlugacz didn't fire the fatal shot, he could still be on the hook for murder just because of what he thought was happening.
You got it. So to get a murder conviction, the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that what the defendant did actually caused the death. That's causation, and it's usually pretty straightforward.
One thing leads to another.
Right, like a chain reaction. But in Dlugacz, the medical evidence was murky. Experts couldn't say for sure if Geller was still alive when Dlugacz fired those five shots.
So how did the court approach this? Did they have to, like, get inside Lugash's head and figure out his intentions?
Pretty much, yeah. The jury had to grapple with Lugash's state of mind. And get this, the court even considered downgrading the charge from murder to attempted murder.
Wait, attempted murder? If the victim was already dead, how can you even attempt to murder them? That just doesn't make sense.
Right. It seems like a paradox, doesn't it? This is where New York's attempt law comes in. This law basically says even if you can't actually commit a crime because of the circumstances, you can still be guilty of trying to do it if you believed it was possible at the time.
Okay, I'm starting to see where this is going. So even if Geller was already dead, if Dlugacz really believed he was shooting a living person, he could still be convicted of attempted murder.
You nailed it. The court zeroed in on Dlugacz's intent. That original murder conviction meant the jury thought he intended to kill someone who was alive. And that same intent, the court said, could mean a charge of attempted murder.
Wow, that's wild. It really shows how much our legal system depends on the idea of intent. But was it really that simple? Did they just say, okay, attempted murder it is, and move on?
Not quite. There was a big procedural issue that complicated things. The jury instructions were a bit of a mess, and that ended up playing a crucial role in how this whole thing played out.
Jury instructions? How could those be a problem?
Well, the instructions for murder and attempted murder weren't consistent. For murder, the jury could presume intent if they found Geller was still alive when Dlugacz shot him. It's kind of like if you see someone holding a smoking gun standing over a body, you might reasonably assume they intended to kill, right?
Yeah, that seems logical. So what was different with the attempted murder instructions?
For attempted murder, they couldn't just presume intent. They had to find actual intent, meaning they had to be sure Dlugacz knew Geller was alive and that he was shooting him to kill him, a much higher bar to clear.
Wow, yeah, that is a big difference. It almost sounds like the jury might have been pushed towards a murder conviction just because it was easier to prove intent in that case.
That's a key point. This difference in the instructions, the court said, could have unfairly swayed the jury towards murder instead of attempted murder. And that raises serious questions about whether Dlugacz got a fair trial.
Okay, so we've got a case with a lot of unknowns, a victim potentially dead before the final shots, a defendant whose intentions are murky, and conflicting jury instructions that might have skewed things. So what happened next? Did the courts just say this is too messy and give up?
Not exactly. The court ended up upholding the decision to throw out the murder charge. But here's where it gets even weirder. Welcome back to our deep dive into the strange case of People v. Dlugacz. We left off with the court dismissing the murder charge against Dlugacz, but, well, they still had to figure out what to do with this very confusing situation.
Yeah, my head's still spinning from that whole jury instruction thing. It's wild how these little procedural details can completely change a trial's outcome.
Absolutely. And the court in Dlugacz was definitely worried that those inconsistent instructions could have led to a wrongful conviction. So they sent the case back to be resentenced on the attempted murder charge.
So even though they couldn't say for sure that Dlugacz actually committed murder, they felt pretty confident that he had tried to.
Exactly. And this decision really changed how the legal system looks at impossibility as a defense, especially in cases of attempted crimes.
Impossibility. So, like, if someone tries to rob an empty bank vault.
That's a great example. Before Lugash, the law wasn't super clear on whether you could be charged with something that was physically impossible to do. This case helped make a distinction between two types of impossibility: factual impossibility and legal impossibility.
Okay, I'm going to need you to break those down for me because they sound like something lawyers made up just to confuse everyone.
Aha! I know, right? The terms can be a bit much. But the ideas themselves are actually pretty simple. Imagine you're trying to pickpocket someone, but it turns out to be a mannequin. You're doing all the actions, but you can't actually complete the crime because there's no pocket to pick. That's factual impossibility.
Okay, that makes sense. What about legal impossibility?
Legal impossibility is when you do something thinking it's a crime, but it's not actually illegal. It's like seeing a sign that says no parking, and you park there anyway, but it turns out the sign is old and parking is now totally legal. You thought you were breaking the law, but you weren't.
Okay, I get the difference. So, how did Lugash change things when it comes to using impossibility as a defense?
Well, before Lugash, courts were kind of all over the place on whether either of those types of impossibility could get you off the hook. Lugash essentially established that what matters most is what the defendant believed they were doing, not the actual reality of the situation.
So, it doesn't matter if the victim was already dead or the bank vault was empty. What matters is whether the defendant truly thought they were committing a crime.
You got it. And that was a pretty big shift in legal thinking. It put a huge emphasis on the importance of intent in our justice system. We punish people not just for what they do, but also for what they were thinking when they did it.
That makes sense. But I can see how focusing on the defendant's belief could be controversial. Couldn't someone just claim they thought they were breaking the law, even if they weren't?
Yeah, that's a legitimate concern, and it's something courts have been wrestling with ever since Lugash. But don't forget, the prosecution still has to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant actually believed they were committing a crime. Just saying, "I didn't know," isn't enough.
So Lugash didn't exactly create this loophole for criminals.
Nope, not at all. It just highlighted how important intent is when figuring out who's responsible for a crime. But the case also showed how crucial it is to have clear and consistent instructions for the jury, especially when you're dealing with tough concepts like intent and impossibility.
Right, we talked about how messed up the jury instructions were in Lugash. What kind of impact did that have on the case, and what did the courts learn from it?
The court in Lugash was really worried that those inconsistent instructions could confuse the jury and lead to an unfair conviction. They basically said you can't have different standards for proving intent depending on the charge.
Yeah, the jury could just assume intent for the murder charge, but had to be totally convinced of actual intent for attempted murder.
Exactly. And the court said that difference wasn't fair to Lugash. It highlighted how important clear, consistent, and fair jury instructions are. It's a fundamental part of due process. The law can be complex and nuanced, sure, but the way you explain it to a jury needs to be just as clear and accurate.
So Dugash, with all its twists and turns, really pushed the courts to rethink how they explain the law to juries, especially when it comes to these tricky ideas of intent and impossibility.
Absolutely. And this case goes way beyond just the legal stuff. Dugash makes us think about some really deep ethical and philosophical questions about justice, morality, and even how we understand reality itself.
Oh, now you've really got me hooked. What kind of ethical dilemmas does this case bring up? Welcome back to our deep dive into People v. Lugash. We've gone through the facts of the case, gotten lost in the legal maze of impossibility, and seen how this whole thing forced the courts to really wrestle with the idea of intent.
And now we're moving out of the courtroom and into the realm of ethics and philosophy, because Lugash isn't just about laws. It makes us think about some really big questions about justice, morality, and even reality itself.
Okay, you've definitely got my attention. What kind of ethical quandaries does this case bring up?
Well, first off, it makes us question the whole idea of punishing someone for something that was never actually possible. Is it really fair to hold someone accountable for trying to do something that couldn't actually happen?
Yeah, it's like we said, the whole case hinges on Lugash's belief, not whether Geller was dead or alive. Are we basically punishing him for what he was thinking?
That's the core of the debate. You could argue that intent is everything. If someone wants to commit a crime and take steps towards it, they should be held responsible even if something stopped them from actually doing it.
It's about stopping harmful behavior, even if no one was actually harmed in that particular instance.
Exactly. And if we let people use impossibility as a get-out-of-jail-free card, it could create this huge loophole in the system. Think about how criminals could exploit that. Oh, I couldn't actually rob the bank because the vault was empty.
I see that side. But then there's the argument that it's just plain wrong to punish someone for something they didn't actually do.
Right, that's a valid point. It brings up the question of whether the punishment fits the, well, the non-crime, I guess. Should someone be punished as harshly for trying something as they would for actually doing it, especially if they were never going to succeed in the first place.
And there's also the problem of figuring out what someone actually believed when they did something. We can't read minds.
Exactly. We have evidence, witness statements, maybe even things the defendant said, but it's never perfect. We could always misinterpret what someone did or said, and that could lead to a wrongful conviction.
This case really makes you think about the point of the justice system. Is it all about punishing bad behavior, preventing future crimes? Or is there something more to it? Tugash seems to blur the lines.
It's a mix of all those things. Cases like this force us to look at those areas where the answers aren't so clear. They make us think critically about balancing individual rights and what society needs, about intent versus outcome, and about what we perceive as reality compared to the actual truth.
It's definitely a lot to wrap your head around, but in a good way. It's important to be challenged to grapple with these kinds of complicated questions.
I agree. And at the end of the day, People v. Tugash reminds us that the law isn't just a bunch of rules. It reflects our values, what we believe, and how we're trying to build a more just and fair world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. It's a great way to wrap things up. This has been a truly fascinating deep dive into a case that's both strange and makes you really think.
It definitely has. And to our listeners out there, we'd love to hear what you think about the ethical questions raised by Tugash. Does focusing on what the defendant believed make the justice system more fair, or does it make things too uncertain and open the door for abuse?
Let us know on our social media. We're always up for a good discussion. And until next time, keep exploring those thought-provoking legal puzzles.